The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I want to thank Alex Wells, who's right over here. He helped with research for this talk. He might be a resource in this discussion. According to Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto, capitalism constantly revolutionizes production. So e-commerce, robotization, electronic work surveillance, school testing mania, charterization, and professional de-skilling today are not the historical exception. Furthermore, such revolutions are intentionally deployed to disrupt worker organization and resistance and to dismantle previous working class gains. But consistent reorganization also unintentionally empowers workers. For example, the rise of e-commerce has put large disruptive power in the hands of logistics industry workers. And social media was a vital tool for organizing teachers in the recent strike wave. This relentless competition and reorganization make class struggle a permanent feature of capitalist life. That means one side is always gaining and one side is always losing in that battle. And today, our class faces a twin crisis. On the one hand, the ruling class has leveraged reorganization since the 1970s to wage a devastating class struggle offensive of austerity and union busting. On the other hand, the Democratic Party disorganizes resistance by posing as our political leader and defender. And more to the point, our union leaderships fail to recognize the party's traitorous role while themselves refusing to organize the kind of desperately needed rank and file struggle that teachers, for example, had to organize on their own this spring. And that's because both the Democrats and union heads believe in, preach, and seek something that's impossible under capitalism: class peace. And the union heads' belief is no accident, according to activists descended from the international socialist tradition, like some in Labor Notes, and like the organizers of this conference. We argue that the paid union officials who largely set the strategy of the U.S. labor movement today have distinct economic interests from their rank and file members. They're not exploited and abused by the bosses of the workers they represent. Instead, their income comes from members' dues. And furthermore, they rub shoulders with the employers, and their jobs depend on negotiating stable contracts, balancing members' and bosses' needs. So they inevitably exercise a conservative influence on union affairs, tending toward reliance on politicians, opposing strikes and militant action, and for those reasons, also opposing real rank-and-file democracy. The union bureaucrats vacillate, depending upon whether pressure from the capitalists above or the workers below is stronger. And they occupy a range of positions from conservative to more progressive bureaucrats. So in West Virginia, the leaders drag their feet. In Arizona, they supported the movement to some extent. In Oklahoma, they betrayed the democratically expressed wishes of the majority of teachers to continue striking. But in no case did the bureaucracy act as a fighting leadership on any consistent basis. The rest of this talk will explore the evolution of revolutionaries' fight to solve this problem of bureaucratic union conservatism. So German immigrants brought anarchist and Marxist ideas into the US union movement that began to grow in the post-Civil War economy of rising corporations. In Chicago, the International Working People's Association built the country's first mass-based union movement with revolutionary leadership in the 1880s, culminating in the nationwide May Day strike for the 8-hour day in 1886. When anarchist Albert Parsons, Marxist August Spies, and other leaders were framed and executed after that, it crushed the movement. But they had proved that unions could be at their most powerful as part of a revolutionary movement, and they proved that revolutionaries' place was in the labor movement. The 1880s also saw the rise of the organized trades and labor unions, later renamed the AFL and the Knights of Labor. Originally left-influenced and against racial segregation, in the 1890s, the AFL evolved toward reluctance to strike and acceptance of racism. These tendencies stemmed from the influence of the union bureaucracy, but also from the old-fashioned craft union structure of AFL unions. Craft unions were too small to shut down production anymore in the new mass production corporate factories, so they couldn't support strikes. And their very narrowness also made them almost always support racist job exclusion policies. The Knights of Labor, on the other hand, grew rapidly to 700,000 members by 1886, basing themselves on the necessarily racially inclusive organization of workers by industry, not by craft skill. The short-lived Knights died, but they implanted the memory of inclusive industrial unionism as the alternative to the exclusive AFL. So in 1905, Eugene Debs, Mother Jones, Haymarket widow Lucy Parsons, Western Federation of Miners leader Bill Haywood, and other popular working class leaders launched the IWW as a brand new union federation, aiming to destroy and replace the AFL with an industrial, anti-racist, strike-positive revolutionary union. The IWW's belief in class struggle meant they organized all workers together by industry, were militantly anti-racist, and led famous and creative mass strikes that invented tactics like mass picketing, the sit-down strike, mass strike meetings with democratic decision-making and representation of multiple immigrant language groups. But there were two other left-wing union strategies in the pre-World War I era. One was that of the moderate wing of the Socialist Party. And socialists like Max Hayes and Morris Hillquit ran for union office or took union staff jobs, hoping to change the union from within the bureaucracy. They sought pro-socialist union resolutions calling for public ownership of industries or union endorsements for Socialist Party political candidates. In 1912, Max Hayes impressively got 30% of the vote running against Gompers for head of the AFL. But these moderate Socialist Party unionists mounted no serious challenge to the outdated structures and disastrously conservative policies of the AFL. The other left strategy emerged from a critique of the IWW. In 1911, IWW railroad worker and anarchist William Z. Foster went to the IWW convention and argued that the failure of their organization to grow into a challenger to the AFL 6 years after its founding required a radical shift. He argued that in France and elsewhere, revolutionary collectives had successfully built powerful anti-capitalist union movements, not by using the dual unionist method of the IWW, but by using, quote, boring from within. He was there at the IWW convention. He said we should dissolve ourselves, we should turn ourselves into a militant minority and join our AFL unions, win control of those unions, and then go in and win control by, quote, building better fighting machines than the bureaucrats. He blamed the tiny IWW for deserting the AFL masses and leaving them in the hands of the conservatives and thereby making the US union movement, which was the world's radical leader in the 1880s, into the weakest in the industrialized world. 5 out of 31 IWW delegates agreed with Foster, and they joined him in 1912 to form the Syndicalist League of North America. Has anyone heard the term syndicalism? Anyone want to try to define it?
That's your job.
Okay. Well, it's just another word. It's a fancy word for unionism. Syndicate means union. It's kind of exotic, but it just means unionism. But historically, it also meant a different kind of union, revolutionary unionism. Powerful syndicalist federations in France, Spain, and Ireland grew as a reaction to the failures and betrayals of reformist socialist parties that started to be elected to European parliaments at the turn of the century. For example, in France, some socialist politicians helped forcefully put down a railroad worker strike. So the syndicalists were turning against all political action and all politics. They said that workers could best fight for gains through strikes, and that revolution wasn't a matter of politics. It was a simple matter of building up for a general strike of all workers, before which the capitalists and their state would be powerless. Foster Syndicalist League members joined their AFL unions and organized as militant minorities in 12 cities. They led strikes, organized thousands of new members, and they won leadership in Kansas City, St. Louis, Vancouver, and other places. They claimed about 2,000 members. The league was weakly organized, and it faded away by 1915. But in Chicago, its core activists continued to work together inside the Chicago Federation of Labor. And Foster and friends pushed for and led the historic 1917 Packing House Workers Union Drive, which allied about a dozen small craft unions to rapidly bring in over 60,000 workers. Foster reached out to black church leaders and Polish immigrant community groups and created multiracial shop steward teams. And all this broke new ground, with the AFL unions moving into industry-wide organizing on a scale the IWW never attempted. And then Foster became a national figure when he took these methods national, bringing 24 craft unions together in the Steelworkers campaign, which culminated in the 1919 strike of 250,000 steelworkers. Both the steel and packing house workers went down to total defeat. But the industrial scale organizing and militant methods foreshadowed the big union breakthroughs of the 1930s. The Russian Revolution of 1917 realized a different model of socialist politics. Russian workers organized themselves into mass democratic citywide workers' councils, or Soviets, that were more all-embracing than unions. As the syndicalists had predicted, the revolution was based on direct action at work, and it was workers' struggle organizations that took over the administration of the post-revolutionary society. But rather than fold before mass organization and general strikes, the capitalist state in Russia used the repression of police forces and the political battle of ideas to try to co-opt, immobilize, and crush the insurgent workers' democracy. The Bolshevik Party worked primarily as a highly organized democratic collective, a militant minority in the way that the syndicalists used to think of it. And they were working primarily to win influence at the grassroots level in every factory. And they gradually won a majority in the workers' councils or Soviets behind their slogan, "All Power to the Soviets." And with that majority mandate for mass action, they selected the right political moment to organize the insurrectionary replacement of the existing government with the Soviets. And this kind of blew Foster's mind. In his terms, he said, this is like a strike raised to the nth degree. That's what he said about it. And previously anti-political syndicalists and anarchists around the world were won over, and they joined the communist parties that sprouted around the world. And this led to a new stage in left union strategy internationally, the Marxist syndicalist synthesis. Both revolutionary Marxists and syndicalists had agreed that capitalism imposes class struggle on the workers, that our only choices are to fight or to lose, and that our gains will never be safe this side of revolution. Now, the syndicalists were won over to the need for politics, a grassroots-oriented politics that recognized the capitalist state would counter-organize, not give up, in the face of a general strike. That revolutions involve spontaneous mass democratic organizing far beyond what unions can ever encompass. And that workers need a full political program to run society, not just a union strategy. But syndicalists also brought important understandings into this new strategy. Rank and file union activist and early British communist J.T. Murphy was a veteran of the wartime Scottish shop stewards movement. In the big anti-war strikes of 1915, these syndicalist shop stewards built rank and file meetings in their shops that made decisions, and then the stewards held meetings that coordinated between the factories. Not unlike the Arizona teachers with their building rep system that they improvised in the spring. For J.T. Murphy, winning union office was sometimes tactically helpful and sometimes not. What was more important in his argument that he made in this new movement and strategy was independent democratic spaces where rank and file union members could directly organize action. So this Marxist syndicalist synthesis was forged and transmitted around the world through the new revolutionary organizations, the Communist International and the Red International of Labor Unions. Foster and his handful of syndicalist collaborators, along with about 2,000 IWW organizers, including Bill Haywood and the famous rebel girl Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, joined the new Communist Party. And with the support of the party, a bigger and better version of the old syndicalist league was launched, the Trade Union Educational League. Finally saying the title of the talk, the TUEL. The TUEL stressed that it was not a dual union. They had to say, look, and they tried to prove it, we don't collect dues. They made a big point about that. We're not a dual union, we don't even collect dues. Foster, in fact, founded the TUEL before he joined the party in 1921, and it was officially not a partisan organization. According to League leader Earl Browder in 1922, he quoted, 90% of the TUEL was outside the party in 1922. It saw itself as a group of, quote, nationally organized rank and file committees trying to, quote, establish a left bloc of all the revolutionary and progressive elements in which, quote, different political persuasions can cooperate. Foster argued that in the bureaucratized AFL, quote, the militants must build machines to fight those of the reactionaries in order to, quote, secure the backing of the mass by showing in the crucible of the class struggle that their theory, tactics, and organizational forms are the best. He said the militants must, quote, surge up from the bottom and compel the static leadership into vigorous, intelligent action or remove it drastically. The TUEL organized in the worst of times. The decade of militancy that had preceded it, which peaked in 1920 when there was a lot of strikes, and 58% of those strikes were wildcat strikes. That collapsed in 1921. In the 20s, we got it bad today. In the 20s, union membership fell from 4 million to 2.1 million. The employers launched the open shop drive. The state brutally repressed leftists with deportations and jail. The union bureaucrats expelled leftists and used thug violence against them. Plus, the young communist movement was inexperienced and factionalized, and the Comintern and the Red International of Labor Unions started out as very helpful advisors, but they degenerated into incompetent sectarian and dictatorial Stalinists after 1923. In parallel with the decline of any democracy in Russia. Foster himself was peculiar in some ways. He had opportunist and elitist tendencies inherited from his anarchist days when he recommended the decidedly anti-democratic works of Friedrich Nietzsche to his followers. Kind of weird. And all of this severely constrained the TUEL's success. Thank you. But synthesizing four decades of international experience in the development of left union strategy, the TUEL were by far the largest group of workers determined to apply what we today call the rank and file strategy in US history. In its healthiest phase, when the Russians advised revolutionaries worldwide to win over the working class through collaborative and democratic methods, the TUEL launched national campaigns for union mergers and for a labor party. They had local chapters set up in 45 cities by the summer of 1922. They had 4,000 subscriptions to their publication, which is called the Labor Herald. They had periodic conferences in the regions, in the eastern, western, and central states, and in Canada. Later they had them in Mexico. So they had the infrastructure to launch some kind of coordinated campaigns between all the rank and file groups in the different unions. So after the demand for unions to set up a labor party emerged organically in different cities, Chicago, New York, and Seattle, and Pittsburgh, the League said, this is the time to campaign for this. So they mailed ballots to 35,000 union locals around the country, and 7,000 of those locals sent the ballots back saying, yes, we endorse a labor party. They got 7,000 locals to endorse that. In Chicago, the League was inside the Chicago Federation of Labor, so they got the Chicago Federation to then in turn push that the AFL as a whole hold a national conference on amalgamation, seen as the way to transition from craft unions to industrial unions. And between March of 22 and December of 1923, the League pushed for and passed amalgamation resolutions in 16 international unions, in 17 state federations, a whole bunch of local labor councils, and thousands of locals. It was actually about 50% of organized labor got behind these TUEL proposals for amalgamation. This early momentum relied on a united front perspective in which revolutionaries sought to work with larger forces to their right, maintaining their independent organization, but working collaboratively where possible. And it was possible. For example, the progressive John Fitzpatrick, head of the Chicago Federation of Labor, worked with the TUEL. He was a supporter of amalgamation, supporter of a labor party. He defended communist involvement in the unions to those who said, hey, it's communists. He defended them. But then, in 1924, the Comintern began to interfere. And they insisted that the party push the TUEL to move forward on this Labor Party convention. Come on, come on, come on. Labor Party convention on their own, even though progressive allies rightly considered this to be a premature step. And predictably, this ended up turning Fitzpatrick against them, against the left. And this opened the door for really damaging attacks on the TUEL nationally. They became targets for union expulsions and firings all around the country. But more importantly, they were still able to continue their rank and file work in the different unions for the next several years. And they had a presence in printing, in shoemaking, the carpenters, food processing, textiles, railroads, the machinists, and those would all be stories worth telling. I'm going to focus on the miners, the ladies' garment workers, and the fur workers. So the World War I years through 1920 saw not only a strike wave with a high percentage of wildcats, but also organized left-wing opposition groups forming within multiple unions. These rank-and-file caucuses form the basis for the TUEL. So in the 300,000-strong mine workers union, President John L. Lewis revoked the charters of actually 24 locals in Illinois in 1919 because they all did wildcat strikes. So he kicked them out. In 1921, he expelled 2,500 miners for striking to get their imprisoned militant leader, Alexander Howitt, out of jail. So the TUEL got together this thing they called, that was called the Progressive International Committee of the UMWA, United Mine Workers, in February 1923. They built it out of these rebel elements. And And then at the 1924 Mine Workers Convention, they were able to rally significant vote totals for anti-Lewis resolutions, for direct election of all staff and officers of the union, simultaneous contract expiration at the different mines, for the six-hour day, nationalization of the mines, reinstatement of Alexander Howitt, and an alliance with the railroad unions. The communist candidate for mine workers president got almost one-third of the vote, despite fraud. Meanwhile, as the coal operators faced severe cost-cutting pressure, their campaign of union busting greatly intensified. So in 1926, the TUEL launched the Save the Union campaign, which Foster said must either replace the Lewis regime or, quote, stimulate it into sufficient activity to save the union from actual destruction. Save the Union endorsed progressive challenger John Brophy for president as a way to further organize the left and prepare to try to save the union. And he also ran on a campaign calling for nationalization of the mines and a labor party. He got more than one-third of the vote, again despite fraud and violence. And John Brophy's assistant was Powers Hapgood, supporter of the TUEL, member of the Communist Party. He was beaten up by thugs in his hotel room at that convention. Save the Union continued on calling for Lewis to organize the non-union mines and doing it on their own, as he largely refused to organize the non-union mines. And the TUEL focused especially on black miners. Then the pressures from the coal operators forced a strike in 1927 against their severe cost-cutting demands. So Save the Union organized kitchens to feed the strikers. And this brought them a lot of popularity. A lot of workers joined the TUEL. A lot started joining the Communist Party, and Communist Party branches started being set up in mining districts. Save the Union convened 1,100 miners together on April 1st, 1928. The National Executive Committee that they elected at that meeting included five black workers. And one of them said it was the first time in 28 years that he was allowed to speak at a union meeting. With the national strike now a year old and dying fast, they took desperate measures. They said, we're going to call out the strategic West Pennsylvania coal pits. This is the Save the Union's desperate attempt to try to shore up the strike. And it was heroic. But it didn't stop the defeat of the strike, which crippled the mine workers and destroyed the Save the Union. In the 100,000 member ladies' garment and 10,000 member fur workers' unions, left-wing opposition groups also formed, especially after the Russian Revolution. In 1919, an organization uniting shop delegates, again this theme that we saw in Arizona, shop delegate system, formed in the ladies' garment workers. And this group, this rank-and-file group, campaigned against behind-the-scenes deals negotiated by the union bureaucrats and for shop-level democracy organized around the shop delegates. In 1922, this group joined, affiliated to the League, and Foster advised them to base their local campaigns around working conditions and union democracy, those issues. They also heavily promoted women workers, like the popular communist garment worker Rose Wardis, in a union that had previously monopolized male leadership over the mostly female workforce. The League successfully elected the leaderships of locals in Boston, the entire joint boards in Chicago and Philadelphia, and then three locals in New York. So in 1925, the head of the garment workers, ladies' garment workers, Morris Sigmund, suspended those three New York locals under TUEL control. But they didn't let that phase them. The three locals formed a joint action committee and they said, let's just keep the union running, even though we're not getting paid salaries. We don't need the official, we can keep the union running on a rank and file basis. And that backed Sigmund off. The joint action committee was so popular that he had to reinstate those suspended locals. The Fur Workers Union formed in 1913 after a militant strike the previous year. The first leader was Isidore Cohen. He was a very moderate right-wing socialist whose famous statement was that one must use the whip against the workers, was his part, what he said about running a union. He was replaced by a reformer and a fellow socialist called Morris Kaufman in 1917, but it really didn't change anything. This was a mafia-infested union, mob-infested union. The shop owners hired mob thugs against the union, and Cohen and Kaufman hired their own mob thugs to protect them against the owners and the workers. Then in 1919, a left-wing Jewish Socialist Federation member, Ben Gold, helped form the Democratic rank-and-file group called the Furriers Agitation Committee. And Gold was elected to the, to the New York Joint Board. In the post-war recession, more than half the New York floor workers got laid off. Then in April 1920, they were forced into a strike. And the bosses hired gangsters to attack the picket lines, and the union hired gangsters to do the picketing. And some of them took money from both sides. But Gold organized rank-and-file members to do the picketing. And he proposed to Kaufman, let's fire the gangsters, let's organize only rank-and-file members to do the picketing. But Kaufman rejected that proposal. And the strike ended in disaster. 50-hour work weeks, no overtime pay, 25 to 50% pay cuts. There were no more union jobs. There was only 650 workers left in the union after all of this. But the remaining members got behind Gold, and they forced Kaufman to resign as head of the New York Joint Board. But he kept control of the National Executive Board, the presidency of the International Union. So at the 1922 convention, the reformers came with proposals. One of them was fire all the gangsters. Another one was organize the unemployed, rebuild the union, and then the other one was elect all union officers. But Kaufman stacked the convention with fake delegates and was able to defeat all of that. The Furriers TUEL section formed later that year, and Ben Gold issued an appeal in this communist Yiddish language, I think he spoke Yiddish, a daily newspaper called Freiheit, means freedom, and he said, quote, "The League strives to guarantee the leadership of the union shall come from the rank and file. The League believes that the shop chairman system, Arizona, should become the established system for running the union." In 1923 contract negotiations, Kaufman was challenged at a meeting on his negotiating proposals. So he ordered his thugs to drive the protesters out of the hall with chairs and knives. Ben Gold got 11 stitches to the head, but the DA threw him in jail, not the thugs. The May 1924 convention, then they expelled Gold and five other left leaders. So on May 25th, that same month, 1924, 1,000 fur workers met and declared their opposition to all of this. The TUEL then won a majority on the New York Joint Board, and they reinstated Gold's membership. In 1925, Gold became manager of the New York Joint Board after another election, and he began a systematic audit of the books of all the locals, these mob-infested organizations. So local officials paid gangsters to come and disrupt the audit of the books, but hundreds of fur workers came to the office to protect the audit every day. One day, the gangsters showed up at Gold's office and held him at gunpoint. And you gotta pay us, we did picketing for you. But Gold said, I didn't pay you. And somehow he had a signal. He signaled the fur workers to drop their tools, and hundreds of them came into the office and disarmed the gangsters and roughed them up. And they left the office with their clothes torn and everything. And they came back sometime after that negotiating, saying, but pay us something, we did picketing for you. And Gold just said, go away or the workers are going to make you regret it. So with the gangsters out, the New York Joint Board launched an organizing campaign. They got a committee of 300 volunteer workers to go around and monitor the different shops against unpaid overtime, to build the support of people when you do that. And then they set up a committee to organize the Greek workers. And it was Greek workers who had done most of the scabbing during the 1920 strike. So in October 1925, 1,500 New York Greek furriers struck for a 44-hour work week, 10 paid holidays, overtime, and a minimum wage. They were out for 10 days and they won a complete victory right in the middle of the 20s. And the open communist Ben Gold later won leadership of the National Fur Workers Union. But in 1928, Stalin consolidated his own bureaucratic regime in Russia, radically eliminating the remnants of a once vibrant workers' democracy. A group led by ex-IWW member James Cannon left the US Communist Party to found the small Trotskyist movement dedicated to democratic revolutionary socialism. For those in the much larger Communist Party left behind, Stalin ordered that you just drop the TUEL, and why don't you try that dual unionism thing again? And William Z. Foster, a national figure, known by labor people around the country, built his entire reputation on opposition to dual unionism, on boring from within, went along. So dual unionism basically failed, and the Communist Party returned to the unions in the 30s. They never fully returned to the real rank and file strategy, especially the collaborative, fully democratic aspect of it. But they still had enough roots in it and were trained enough in it. And they still had the form of local branches, which would kind of work like an organized militant minority and a way of organizing a militant minority inside local union groups. That in the giant strike wave of the 30s, they played a vital role. By the 1940s, the Communist Party led 11 national unions. These were expelled from the CIO as McCarthyism started. But the expelled unions, including the dock workers, the electrical workers, and the furriers, still practiced a degree of bottom-up democracy and also feminism and black liberationist politics that deserves to be remembered and studied. As for the full rank-and-file strategy, that was kept alive by the Trotskyists. In the 1934 Teamsters General Strike in Minneapolis, you can read the famous case study of this, the handbook, in a way, for this type of organizing, Teamster Rebellion. It was also key to the Flint sit-down strike at GM in 1937, really considered the turning point, the Gettysburg of U.S. labor, in which the victory meant that the floodgates were opened and mass industry in the United States was finally organized and the balance of class forces changed in favor of workers in a way that it has not done since or before in the history of the country. We got to give the rank and file strategy some credit for that. It also continued, again, with the Trotskyists in rank and file caucuses, in the auto workers and longshoremen caucuses that they had in the 40s, and the International Socialists through Teamsters for a Democratic Union and Miners for Democracy in the 70s. The International Socialists split in the 70s, with one group carrying on with the Labor Notes Network and the ISO concentrating on recruiting a new generation of socialists on campus as the country swerved to the right in the Reagan era. While never abandoning labor or a rank-and-file strategy, the ISO was able to train a small new generation of members who began to play founding roles in rank-and-file groups and several teachers and other unions in the new century. Today's labor leftists, like the moderate socialists or the communists from the 30s onward, often take union staff jobs or run for office, run for e-board as individuals, so hoping to change the bureaucracy. Others are still trying to push dual unionism in the IWW. And for most, socialist convictions take a back seat to day-to-day union work. But our labor movement's greatest potential has been glimpsed to the degree that revolutionaries worked inside unions as collectives, seeking a dynamic synthesis of socialist organizing and union organizing, each reinforcing the other. That's it.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org. a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.